Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and this morning's conversation is with Michael Astru, Commissioner of the U.S. Social Security Administration. Also joining us in our conversation from IBM is Nicole Gardner. Michael, I want to go back to something that you mentioned in the last segment around a National Academy of Science study. I believe you said it was from 2006. The study noted that SSA's aging IT infrastructure further compounds some of the challenges that you all are having. And you've acknowledged the need to rigorously explore new technologies. Could you elaborate more specifically on your efforts in this area to modernize SSA's IT infrastructure? And what new investments are you making in this area?
Sure. One of the useful things that was pointed out in the National Academy of Sciences report was that we have almost 40 million lines of COBOL code. It works, but it is rigid. It is hard to modify that. The cost of maintaining it increases well above inflation every year because it's harder and harder to find people who are trained in COBOL, harder and harder to retain them, both for cost reasons and for flexibility and adaptability reasons. We are trying, as we move to electronic services, not just to do things the way we did before, which was to come up with new COBOL-based programs, but we're trying to go to web-based systems. We're trying also to go do some replacement of the core of our system, and this is probably the one area where we'll probably in the short run fall a little short of what the National Academy of Sciences recommended, and although it gets very complicated, we're probably not going to get all the way there on my watch. It's extremely expensive, and the ability to make that change in mid-course without damaging services to the public is very daunting. And I think they may have underestimated a little bit the cost and technical difficulty of this. And the cost issues are complicated by the fact that we have to put a higher priority on replacing the National Computer Center, because at the end of the day, if the physical building falls apart or we can't put any more electricity in there to put more servers in, that's going to start crimping our ability to even do our most basic work.
Now, along with these 40 million lines of code, I also understand that you store about 250 million medical documents. So what are the implications of SSA in this area, and what role does SSA play in working to standardize the storage and transmission of these medical records in a uniform and electronic format?
Sure. We are the largest repository of medical records in the world, and it's very important for us to stay on top of healthcare IT. And it will have a number of applications for us, but the most important one is one of the big causes of error in disability determinations and one of the big causes of delay is the difficulty of getting a complete medical file on an individual. Increasingly, people's health care is fragmented. It's not like the old days where if you hurt your back, the same Marcus Welby that had been treating you for 20 years wrote the 3-page report. Our medical care is so much more fragmented. If the nation moves quickly to where I think everybody is trying to get it, and everybody has a full electronic medical record. What that means is that with the transfer of that into our system, it dramatically speeds up and makes more accurate our processes. So we're trying to do that as much as possible. We have a pilot in Boston. Beth Israel Deaconess is right on the cutting edge of all of this, and so we're now getting electronic records from them on most of our claimants and working out the kinks in that system. That's moving extremely well. We're trying to expand that now, and so instead of going randomly around the country, we're trying to give a real acid test, and we've looked at some of the places where the filings are going up dramatically, where we're struggling to handle the workload. So we're looking at what we can do in Michigan and Ohio, and we're planning on seeing if we can enroll the Cleveland Clinic. There are a couple associations of healthcare providers in Michigan that are moving along with electronic records and try to see if we can move as aggressively as we can in that area, because that will be a huge time saver for us, money saver for us, but more importantly, we'll make better decisions because incomplete medical records is one of our biggest causes of error.
So shifting gears for a minute here, it's been fairly well documented that in the past decade, and certainly for the first time since the Great Depression, the personal savings rate in the U.S. has fallen below zero. Could you tell us a bit more about the special initiative called Encourage Savings? How does this expand SSA's outreach efforts to encourage savings and retirement planning within the U.S.?
I think this is a very important topic. The fact that our savings rate is so low that it actually went negative for a while recently is a very bad thing for individuals generally in their lives. It's a horrific thing for their retirement planning. And it's a very, very bad thing for the economy. Without savings, we just don't have as much capital investment, and that's what an economy needs to grow. So for both micro and macro reasons, we need to do more savings as a nation. And when I went through the confirmation process, this is something I heard loud and clear from a number of the senators, particularly our chairman, Max Baucus. One of the things we did with the strategic plan is we said, how can we promote that goal without taking on huge new workloads? And of course, one of the things that's remarkable about the agency is we have about 350 million communications written with the American public each year. And so, well, in general, we're trying to thin these down, make them clearer, shorter, that type of thing. Some of them do provide us an opportunity to try to preach the importance of savings, and particularly to get people to some of the government-sponsored objective websites about financial literacy that can be very helpful, like www.mymoney.gov. Because there are a lot of things that are available on the web, but people are rightly suspicious of a lot of those things because they worry that the sponsor has a bias. So, for instance, most Americans between the ages of 25 and 65 get an annual earnings statement with, you know, my signature on it. What we're doing now is we're doing inserts, which we can do very, very cheaply, separate piece of paper, with different messages to people as they age. So for younger Americans, we're going to try to promote the value of savings, try to get them to understand the importance of compound interest and those kinds of things that can help drive a higher level of savings. As you get closer to retirement, we'll be doing more messaging about what you have to think about in terms of your retirement choices, pointing people to the online estimator, which recently won the Best Online Service in Government Award from the University of Michigan, to file online because that helps us and helps other Americans. So we have a tool there in the earnings statement where we can send nuanced messaging that's appropriate generationally. And we're starting that now. It'll take us a couple years probably to fine-tune that and get that as good as it needs to be. But I think that's important. And we're looking for those kinds of opportunities, basically to use our bully pulpit in a very cost-efficient way to try to influence behavior.
Michael, the scale of what Social Security is dealing with is really daunting when you think about the many, many transactions and communications. Social Security pays $650 billion in benefits to about 60 million people annually. When you add Medicare and Medicaid, that's 44% of our federal spending. So on the somewhat less positive side, what are you doing to help SSA to be a good steward of the public trust and make sure that we're reducing improper or overpayments? And what are you doing to protect from waste, fraud, and abuse?
Social Security, one of the things we're proud of is that we've always been a can-do agency. In terms of payment accuracy, we've always been the best in government. There's almost no error, for instance, in the retirement programs. Where most of the error comes is in the SSI program, which is the welfare disability program. And it's extremely complex by statute, and month-to-month changes in income, expenditures, assets can affect someone's status. So there's a built-in error rate there. We're, I think, quite good now. We're trying to get better. We collect far more than a majority of the overpayments that we make. Some simplification by the Congress actually could be very helpful in that regard. But we're also doing more reviews of people who are on disability to make sure that their medical condition hasn't improved. One of the things that happened in this decade as the budget contracted and the workloads grew is that that workload got thrown overboard. And I'm not being critical of that choice, but that's one of the reasons why you have to be so aggressive about the online services and reducing other workloads, because at the end of the day, there are tens of billions of dollars that will be wasted if we don't do disability reviews on a timely basis. And the Congress, I think, has come around to understanding that and it did make some adjustments in our appropriations, gave us some flexibility in some cases where we needed it so that we can start increasing the disability reviews back up to the level where they should be optimally from a program integrity point of view. We're not quite there yet, but probably in the next year or two, if the trend lines stay the same, we should be about where we should be.
So picking up on that theme of workload, over the years, as you said, your staff load, your staffing levels have decreased, your responsibilities have increased, your budget has decreased, and a lot of the service could have suffered. Some of it hasn't, but some of it certainly can in the future. Given the mission of the organization and how it's evolving, how have you sought to remedy the situation with a decreasing level of staff? And what's the impact to transform customer service capabilities so that you can continue to be a benchmark and a model for the rest of government?
A lot of this is pretty basic meat and potatoes management. We've gone relentlessly to look for simplifications. Simply eliminating the birth certificate requirement saved an enormous amount of time and energy for our people and for the American public. And it turned out we really didn't need it. There were now other ways that we could authenticate for most Americans, not all, but for most Americans that we could do a proper authentication without it. So we're looking at those things, better systems, better communications too. I mean, one of the things that frustrated me, I discovered that, you know, I'd been away from the agency for about 15 years. And in that time frame, the office that focused on notices had been abolished at one point. And when I go back to what I said before, with 350 million notices going out, to have that on automatic pilot is a big problem. In a lot of cases, we were adding to our own workloads because we were giving improper or unclear direction to the public as to how to interact with us. I mean, they need a lot of information to come in and apply for disability or to apply for a replacement Social Security card. And if we're not clear and succinct with the American public, we're going to frustrate them and we're going to add to our own workloads. So we not only have a notices office, it's a significantly titled a notice improvement office. And so we're looking for ways, again, just very basic management to simplify things and really take the incredibly precious time of our people who work in the field offices and use it for those complicated human interactions where it's absolutely necessary, and then try to take as many of the routine information exchanges onto other methods of communication, whether it's better paper communication, better communication by the people in the teleservice centers, more online services, more online information. Our website had won several awards, but I looked at it particularly from the angle of online services, and it just wasn't good enough. It was cluttered. It was designed for someone who was already familiar with us. It wasn't designed for someone hitting us for the first time and needing help. And for me, that was paramount. So amid a little bit of grumbling, made them redo it all from scratch. And now that we've done it, everybody loves it. I think we're going to win more awards going forward. We've already won one, apparently. And the awards don't really matter. What matters is what helps the American public the most. And the new website, which is cleaner, simpler, has more queuing for people when they get confused, that's really what matters. And it is the big pipeline into a lot of the electronic services. So it's important that it be done well and that we hold the line over the years and it doesn't get cluttered over time.
Well, that's fantastic. And I'm sure it'll help a lot as the availability of workers decreases. And to that end, 53% of the total workforce, including 70% of your supervisors, are going to be eligible to retire by fiscal year 2017. A lot of them, those baby boomers we were just talking about. And with that comes a significant loss of institutional knowledge. What sort of strategies are you putting in place for knowledge management or other things to deal with that loss of expertise over time?
Well, it's no accident that in the strategic plan, in addition to the specific objectives, you know, we flagged that investment in technology and investment in people were the two key ingredients to success. And we are trying to do that with the people. So we have brought in a real pro from the outside in what we used to call our training office. And I think it's a significant sign of the change in the culture that that's now going to be the learning office, and that we are looking much more creatively at how to use all the new technologies so that people can learn more faster and enjoy the experience more. Our training is very good. Our accuracy rate is very high for the newly trained, but it is very time-consuming, and I think most of the people who've been through it will tell you it's painfully dull. So we're trying to improve the quality of the experience. We think we may be able to shorten the length of it a little bit and pick up some productivity, but we're also trying to make sure that people develop in a culture where learning over time, reinvesting in yourself, reinventing yourself is expected, and that we support that with a wide array of online video on demand and those kinds of things. So we've got, I think, some good things happening in that regard. You know, clearly we've already, in some places, we've lost expertise that you can't replace. But you do the best that you can. One of the things that we've done, I think our SES candidate pool had been too narrow, and it was done too much by time and grade. And so we had people just coming up to the top level, and they were already retiring. If you want to work till you're 75 or 80, we've got people. I've given out several 60-year service pens recently. That's a great thing, and we want to encourage that. But I think we also needed to expand that pool for a number of reasons. So we've allowed 14s in for the first time. So our new SES candidate pool, it's younger. It's got a broader range of skill sets. It's actually more diverse because it brings more people in from the regions. It's a little harder to get your 15 in the regions. And we're pulling people in, particularly from San Francisco, Denver, and the San Francisco regional offices that give us an even better diversity profile than what we've had before for senior management. Generally, you know, we do extremely well. We're usually best or next best in the federal government by most metrics in terms of diversity. But it's important that people get every chance at the upper levels as well.
So, Michael, I only have a minute left, but could you elaborate a bit on the agency's recruitment strategy, specifically, I believe, a program called the National Recruitment Program?
Sure. What we do is we really commit to recruiting nationally. We recruit aggressively on college campuses. One of the reasons that we are so diverse is we leave out no part of the country. We've also made a special effort with the military and with the wounded warriors, and we do special events for them. And I went to the one we had at our Baltimore headquarters recently. One of the things that I was at one sense selfishly pleased about but sad about more broadly is how many of them came up and in the course of thanking me for doing this said other agencies weren't doing this and that this was a huge thing from their vantage point. So I think one of the things that we're doing very well is reaching out to the recent veterans, not only when they're applying for disability benefits, where we do have some fast-track procedures for them, but also a lot of them bring enormous discipline, commitment to public service, and knowledge from their military experience into the agency. And we want to tap into that talent pool as much as we can.
That's fantastic. What does the future hold for the U.S. Social Security Administration? We will ask Michael Astrew, Commissioner of the U.S. Social Security Administration, to share with us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.